darling.
Now, that, tell me a little bit about your reweaving, because you said that was over a period of some 5 or 6 years,
yes.
Something like that.
Well, the kind of reweaving that this school taught was piece weaving. You would cut out a little piece of the material that was hidden someplace in a pocket or in the cuffs of pants, anywhere you could find it. Had to be exactly the same weave going the same direction and so forth. Fringe it on four sides and place it on top over the hole, and then this special needle, which I will even show you afterwards, would go in from the front and come out and pick up each thread and put it exactly where it went, you see. Now, on some materials, it came out perfect. If it were a plaid or something like that, basket weave also, but it depended a lot on the color and the weave. If, for instance, gabardine, which is just a plain color and very fine, you have to do French weaving. And that is done one thread at a time. For every thread that's missing, it has to be pulled a little bit back on the back side, and then the new thread goes in a little bit over for a few little stitches, and then it's all rewoven exactly. And that can come out perfect with gabardine and certain materials where piece weaving will show. Piece weaving, of course, is much quicker. So both of us did the weaving. However, I did most of the finer work because my eyes seemed to be better. We used a magnifying glass and pinned it to a brick covered with material and worked that way. And he did the tweeds and the heavier materials and also all the picking up and delivering. We contacted cleaning stores and we made a measurement so that they could measure the hole, and a sheet that gave the price that went with each measurement. And this way we had quite a few cleaning stores. Also, we worked with two French weavers. One was Antoine, the French weaver in Hollywood, and we did piece weaving for him, and he did French weaving for us. So Mac was always going back and forth. I guess I should mention, and I called him Mac because for a while he went by, used a little different name when the immigration was looking for him, so I really got used to calling him Mac. So, of course, there were quite a few. It wasn't as boring work as you would imagine because there's so many different weaves, and I figured out ways with some materials weaves you could take two threads at a time or three or even four, and so it was more like doing a puzzle all day. It was sort of satisfying because all the customers would come in so worried. Some of them had borrowed a garment from somebody else, and here they had gotten a burn in it or torn it, and we had a tailor who made mistakes and burned some things. We had to cover them up for him. And anyway, it was quite satisfying. So this lasted for, until about all the time until he did get put deployed.
And you made a fairly good living at this.
Well, we made a living at it, yes. We even were able to save a little bit of money because it came, we figured we should have a little bit saved up because anything could happen during the McCarthy period. Now, talking more about the McCarthy period, actually, it didn't start at the, when McCarthy got very active in Congress. It started right at the end of World War II, because that's when I was working for Arthur Murray, and that's when I finally got fired when the Taft-Hartley bill was passed. Mrs. Murray and he were so excited about that, they pinned up articles from the newspapers and had copies made and pinned them on all the bulletin boards all over. And of course, these anti-union things started way back then. And also, Churchill made his speech in 1947 in Missouri, great anti-Soviet speech. Of course, there had been anti-Soviet Sovietism in the United States ever since the Russian Revolution.
Yes. But
there was a little let up during World War II when they were an ally of the United States. So when he did get arrested for deportation, he was let out on at least, he was only held a few days, and then he came back, and it took about 2 years until the final order of deportation came through, because they kept on having different hearings, and of course he advised the lawyer to use the Fifth Amendment,
take the Fifth,
The lawyer advised him. In fact, he had a new lawyer that hadn't belonged to the Committee for the Protection of Foreign Born, and he made the mistake of not sending this material that Mack had given him to send to the lawyer in New York, because when the case finally came up, the very final thing, she didn't have anything on him, and it just looked like he was arrested for illegal entry. She called up, and I guess the lawyer told him a little bit over the phone, but he did, they did decide to deport him. There wasn't any use of taking it any farther. As I mentioned before, everybody that was held for deportation from England, the deportation went through, like Harry Carlyle. He was a Hollywood writer, and he was from England, and he was deported there, and several others that I knew. So when we had to at that time then decide where we were going to go. Mac didn't want to go to England because he had terrible lungs and, you know, the weather there. He hated England anyway because of the rigid class distinctions, but it was mainly the weather that bothered him, because if we went to England, we figured we could certainly get into political work sooner than we could in Mexico, where we didn't know the language. We didn't know at that time that you can be deported very rapidly if you do any kind of belong to anything political or do anything political in Mexico. But he sort of wanted to go to Australia, but that seemed so far away from everybody we knew, my family and friends. And also, he didn't push it too much because he was always figuring he was going to get back into the United States. He really just loved the United States. Not that he loved the things they did to him and did to everybody else, but he liked the American people, and he always dreamed of getting back there. Anyhow, after we decided that the Immigration Department allowed him to take voluntary departure if we would pay the way, and he figured that might make it easier for him to get back, so we decided to take voluntary departure and deportation. Mm-hmm. Well, they called it voluntary departure. Mm-hmm. In that was the fall of 1954. So that actually he kept up with the re-weaving for about 2 years after he was first arrested. And of course during that period, I don't think I mentioned, I was very active in the IPP, that's the Independent Progressive Party that ran Wallace right after the war. And then after he got arrested, we got very active also in the Committee for the Protection of Foreign Born, headed by Rose Sherman. And anyway, when the final order came, we went down by car. We took our old car. We always had old cars. And Thomas McGrath, the poet, went with us. And at the border, we had to turn in some papers to the American immigration, and they came over with the papers to the Mexican immigration. And the Jefe was not on duty on the Mexican side, and the people that were there didn't want to let us through, so we just sat, even when the Jefe came. I think he was trying to get a little extra gratificación, because we waited about 5 or 6 hours. We said, well, we were just going to stay there until we got in. They acted as if they weren't going to let him in. So finally he got in, and they did say they would be down regularly to Ensenada to collect some tax from them, but we never did hear from them after that. So in Ensenada we found a little motel, reasonable motel, that had a little kitchenette, and he stayed there, and I went back to the United States and would come down weekends because I had to get rid of the business, clear that up, and this lasted a month or two, and then I came down and we got a very reasonable little house to rent, and he had made friends in the meantime with the two families that had been deported a little before he was deported. These were Mexican Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we couldn't stay there too long because we were let in on a tourist card, which is 6 months. So before the 6 months was up, we went to Mexico City to get information about how we could get papers to stay in Mexico longer, and also we had to go from there either to British Honduras or Guatemala to get new tourist cards because Matt couldn't go back to the States to get them. His deportation papers had said if he ever tried to enter the United States, it was some terrific amount of money he'd have to pay, and so many years in jail, I don't remember. And they even stamped that in his British passport. Anyhow, so in Mexico City, we stayed with a friend of a friend. She was quite well known in Mexico City, Bernice Coco. She's dead now. She was a very famous photographer who had exhibits and various artists. Anyway, we stayed with her a few days and then went down on our trip to British Honduras. And that was a very nice little trip. That is in the Yucatan, and it was just a territory at that time. We went to a little old-fashioned, well, it's all made of wood, which is very unusual. All the houses were very unusual for Mexico, Chetumal. But in that area, there's a lot of mahogany and hardwood forests and so forth, so everything is wood. And we took this cheerful little bus down to the capital of British Honduras, Belize, and the driver would stop at all these towns to visit, say hello to friends of his and ask how the new baby was and get the latest news, and he would stop and pick custard apples and hand them to everybody on the bus, and everybody on the bus was singing and so forth. They would come up to Mexico because it was cheaper for them to come. It was about a day's trip from the capital, which was Belize, to Mexico, to Chetumal, and get their groceries, buy a lot of things there. It was cheaper than to buy them in this British colony where everything was imported from England or other parts of Europe. Everything was much more expensive. And the bus driver was also very nice. The next we saw the Mexican consul, and he gave us a new tourist card. And the bus driver, the next morning where we were all to meet, he wanted to show us, do a little sightseeing, so he took us on a little sightseeing trip first, and nobody on the bus seemed to mind. That was the most cheerful, fun trip I ever took, I think, on a bus. And when we got back, then we got back and went back to Ensenada, because while we were in Mexico City, we had also looked up a progressive lawyer and talked it over about how we could get emigrante papers, they call it, and we've gotten all that information, so that when we got back, we wrote this pamphlet about for people that wanted to live in Mexico, where the cost of living was very cheap then.
And you're going to allow me to copy that?
Yes. And Matt was always thinking of ideas. He had the most fertile imagination of anybody I ever knew. We didn't put many of them to work, but anyway,
we broke it out in the court.
Actually, we found the ads were so expensive for that booklet that we thought we'd earn a little money, that we just put an ad in the Los Angeles paper and sold quite a few of them at $1. And I would we were at the post office box in Los Angeles, and friends of mine took care of getting them and come down to us and bring the money.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we had some left, I wrote the public libraries, and we sold all that was left to
the public
libraries.
And now they're all over.
All over.
Oh, how wonderful.
I don't remember that really, how much all over.
Yes.
We sold,
well, you sold
the bulk
had,
of
yes.
them to the public libraries. So then we were living in Ensenada in this little house, several months is all, and we decided we better get down to Mexico and get prepared for our next trip. We would have to get out of the country in 6 months again. So we were very fortunate in Mexico City. We got a two-bedroom furnished apartment. It was a small apartment, but actually it was a sublet from a French woman she had put up Jewish people in her home in France while Hitler was there. And she rented it to us for $20 a month. That's how things worked in there. In fact, we were able to live while we were down there on about $100 a month.
For both of us?
For the two of us, yes. Of course, we didn't live very lavishly. But this lawyer started getting papers for us, and he finally got papers for us as technicians, because at that time you could be entered as a technician and teach some special
skill
to a Mexican person. So we had two Mexican people, and we carried on this work this was from 1955 to 1962 that we carried on this work. It took us almost 2 years to get our papers. There's so much red tape. And for instance, once it was September, we got a note from immigration saying that our application had been turned down and we must be out of the country by July 20th, which had already passed. Of course, this got us worried, but the lawyer took care of us. In fact, he became a quite good friend of ours, and when he got married, we went down with him on his honeymoon to Acapulco.
Uh-huh.
We stayed in a different hotel. But for about 2 years, I taught English lessons to private people in their homes. I would go in their homes so people, you know, it wasn't really known that I was working. And also, we went, and Mac started painting then. When he had tuberculosis, somebody had given him a whole box of oil paint, and he started painting. The paintings you see here are what he painted in Guadalajara. And he also went to the school where you learn various popular arts. He took pottery and weaving and mosaic. In fact, I took mosaics and weaving, too. I wove a whole rug, about the size of a double bed, in one day. This is a hand weaving, using your feet, this way and that.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept busy during those 2 weeks, and finally when we got our papers, then we started and did the same thing there.
Mm-hmm.
We worked for both cleaning stores, and I taught this young girl who had been a maid for a friend of ours, and they had fired her because she used to visit us from time to time, and I would teach her a little English. She wanted to learn English, and one day she got back at their house 15 minutes late and got fired. So we hired her and taught her how to reweave. In fact, when we got our papers and left Mexico City for Guadalajara, we gave the business to her.
Oh.
And she has been able to support about 10 people on that.
Ever since?
Well, I mean her brothers. Yeah. Have, actually, there are three. She had a daughter herself, and then she took care of a daughter of one of her sisters.
Mm-hmm.
That had daughters, and she raised them, and brothers and family members were there all the time, and she is still doing it. Every time I go to Mexico City, I see her. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, yes. And I saw her the last time I was there. In fact, when I go through Mexico any place, I call her up on the telephone.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
She's still in the same apartment.
Isn't that
but the rent has gone up from 250 pesos, which was the pesos now, now it's like 30,000 pesos. Well, now I guess it's more than that. I mean, before the last evaluation, it was, well, I guess that was right. Anyway, it's just out of this world. But even in American money, it's gone up a terrible amount. So, we had to do the re-reading for 5 years in order to become
a technician.
Yes, you become then an immigrato.
Oh,
means you're finally an immigrant. You have legal residence, and you can do anything you want except work in a restaurant or cabaret.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do political either for money or for volunteer or anything. And so as soon as we got the final papers, we met. There were quite a few Americans down there and quite a few that were down there from some of the Hollywood 10. For instance, we knew Albert Moss very well. And, every time the Mexicans were on strike or having some problem like that, they would arrest Americans and blame it on foreigners that they said were red, you know. So every time anything happened that it looked like the progressives down there might get arrested, somebody would telephone, everybody would get out of the city for a few days, and then after that blew over, you'd come back to the city. In the meantime, I was going home once a year because my family had left us this Scribner, Grain and Elevator Company. We were all directors of it, so I got my fair paid round trip to the United States every year to have the meeting of the Scribner, Grain and Elevator Company. That's right, which never did make anything. I mean, it was ridiculous. They sold so much. I mean, they would do $1 million worth of business and there wouldn't be any profit. Of course, nobody in the family was there really running it or looking at it. And it's a gamble, the way the prices go up and down in grains and so forth. I suppose maybe they made a little bit. Anyway, we finally sold that to a cooperative group of farmers. So we were glad to get rid of that.
Was that all of the children were part of this?
Yes, there were six of us.
Yes,
and my brother was the president. I think I was the vice president for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we would meet in Omaha, Nebraska, and then drive out and go to the elevator and find out, try to learn what we could about it. And I know there was it caused a lot of family controversy, too, because I didn't want to spend much money, and they didn't have it. My brother, you know, who was running it, had big ideas, and we bought this very expensive pelleting machine to make pellets to sell for cattle feed, and that we never did get the money back on that even. Anyway, as I said, we finally got rid of that, and that was fine. So, when we got our final immigration FAME book, it's called, we decided to go into business in Guadalajara. Now, we didn't decide on Guadalajara right away. We had several ideas. Every time I went up to the United States, I would take some popular arts with me and stop in San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, all of these places I knew people, and would go to stores and see how they liked various things, and I found that we could have an export business quite easily, because the things that we bought sold these stores
readily.
Yes, liked them very much. The only trouble was it was hard to have a, if they wanted a certain thing, you couldn't always be sure that you could get it, because these people that are working in their homes on these handicraft things, if somebody walks in and has money and so many things are made, even if it's made for somebody's order, if we've ordered, they will sell it. So when we found this out, we decided that it was no good, and we finally decided to go in to start a secondhand furniture store. Because when I was doing reweaving, I was called to do reweaving for an American who had a used furniture store. He had very high class furniture. It was called Kosas, in the Zona Rosa, it's called now. And he would get, for instance, a living room set that might have a little burn in the sofa. Well, you know how much it costs to recover one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So I could weave that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was saving a lot of money, and I could charge practically what I wanted to. So we got acquainted with him that way, and he told us when we got our papers that we could go into the same business if we wanted to, as long as we didn't in Mexico City, to give him competition. So we looked around Guadalajara, and we found this beautiful, great big house on a street a little out of the center of town, but it looked like it was the coming area. It is now called the Zona Rosa of Guadalajara. And that's where we opened our second-hand store. Well, we put in ads in the paper there that we would sell furniture for people on commission, figuring that it would do well like he did, because a lot of people don't like to put ads in the paper and have all sorts of people coming into their house. And some of these wealthy people figure that somebody may come in to look the place over and coming back to rob it, you see, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we found it didn't go very well, because they didn't know us, they didn't know anything about selling on consignment, they hadn't heard of it. And we got a few customers, but a precious few. The Americans that would see our ad would come in thinking we had furniture to sell, and they'd say, you should call it Algo de Nada instead of Algo de Todo. We had named it something of everything. It's Algo de Todo. So we found out that we had to buy furniture and sell it. And we just had to learn how. We looked at ads of people that were leaving and selling furniture, and when they were selling it for half price, we would go and buy what we thought was good, or buy the whole apartment. So we finally got pretty well established in that. The first few months, we had two beautiful big rooms upstairs, and they each had bathrooms with them in this place. We had students that we rented it to while we were getting going. Anyway, we got started and did very well at it. And except the landlord wanted to raise the rent all the time, and he really wanted us to move, because he really wanted to take down the building, although it was quite a new building. It was a big house with 6 bedrooms and lots of other space, a split level dining room where the furniture showed off so well. It had a garden as you entered, then it had a big patio and a garden in the back. We had dogs, because my husband loved dogs, and also he figured that was a protection. Nobody ever tried to break in or rob the place, and we furnished lots of apartments and houses for people there and in Lake Chapala. Finally, we moved to a smaller place because the rent was, he was very desperate to get rid of us. And we had bad luck there, because as soon as we moved, we read that they were going to take that house down and make a new highway there.
So Margaret, I think we have to end.
Yes.
Thank you very much.